Join us at Money Marketing Interactive London on the 29th of September. Just go to mmilondon.moneymarketing.co.uk to secure your seat at our industry-leading event and hear from notable figures in the industry. See you there.
Hello and welcome to the Money Marketing Podcast. My name is Lois Valerie, Chief Reporter at Money Marketing, and for this episode, I'm joined by Bud, Founder and Chair of the IFW, and Ruth Sturkey, who is Vice Chair. Now, the IFW previously stood for the Initiative for Financial Wellbeing, but as many of you will have seen, at the end of August, the organisation announced that it had been granted institute status by the now former Business Secretary. Chris and Ruth, huge congratulations and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lois.
So perhaps you could start off by introducing yourselves and telling our listeners a bit about yourselves. Maybe if we start with Chris.
Yeah, okay. So I founded a financial planning company called Ovation Finance back in, I started in 1998, 2 years self-employed, then Ovation, sold it to an employee ownership trust about 5 years ago. I wrote the financial wellbeing book in 2015, and I'm actually just finishing writing a second one. And part of that, I Googled it. So what I do, when I had the phrase, the title financial wellbeing, I Googled it, and there were two entries on that search. Two entries for financial wellbeing on a Google search. And I Googled it again recently, and there's now 212 million entries on a Google search for financial wellbeing. So, yeah, it's come quite a long way in quite a short time. So, yeah, that's me.
Great. Ruth?
And Lewis, I co-founded the Red House, which was a financial planning business in 2007 with my two colleagues. And we ran that for 10 years and we're very proud of what we achieved. We merged it into Paradigm Norton, gosh, 4.5 or so years ago, I think it was. And I now remain at Paradigm Norton as a non-executive director. And I came across the IFW a few years ago, but I didn't take very much notice. And over the last year or so, Chris and the team at the IFW have become more and more conscious to me. And the more I've learned about financial wellbeing and all the good work that's going on at the IFW, I just wanted to get involved. And the more I learn, the more I want to learn. And so I've very much enjoying getting up to speed and learning about all the good the IFW are doing. I'm very excited for what happens next.
Perfect. Thank you. And I think it's a really important topic. So before we get on to talking about a bit of the history of the IFW, I'd just like to ask you both a question. So what are we actually talking about when we say financial wellbeing? And also, why do you think it's so important? Do you think it's sort of become more important in recent years? And if so, why do you think that is? I don't know who wants to start there.
If I start with a what is, and then Ruth could talk about direction of travel and mm-hmm. Her framing of it, which I really like. So financial well-being for me, and look, I mean, this is going to sound awfully arrogant, but it's kind of true that I did actually invent this. So I think I've got a good grounding for being able to make statements like what it means. It's a whole area of study, very general and very broad, about the relationship between money and happiness. So I know some people have said, well, financial well-being is just what happens when I do good financial planning. That's not what financial well-being means. It's an area of study, and it's a very broad area of study as well. It brings in psychology, things like Buddhism. You know, there's lots of people have been looking at this for many thousands of years now, about what makes us happy. But what's never really happened in any great depth is it's never really been applied to the financial planning process, to the world of finance. So it's about, and what the IFW stands for, is about helping people to be happier by having a better relationship with their money. And we could talk about, you know, how and what that means in some depth. But I think it's a really important starting point to understand that it is a broad and very wide area and really interesting and fun area too.
And from when I think about the direction of travel, And particularly, you know, Chris and I are both financial planners at heart, and we both run successful financial planning businesses. And how I've kind of made sense of it myself as I've got, you know, scratched the surface and got deeper into this is if financial planning itself is actually quite a young profession, and I use that word reservedly because there's still a debate about whether it is or it isn't. But if we think about our evolution over the last 20 to 30 years, there was a time when people were just selling products. Let's be generous and say most of those products were sold well, but they were sold to a need that the client presented with. I think if we go back about 10, 15 years or so, we then started to see the introduction of the things such as cash flow planning, platforms, evidence-based investing. In my head, I've seen that as the second iteration. All of a sudden, we've now got, with the introduction of behavioral science and reflecting on the importance of coaching skills, I think what we've got is financial planning 3.0. So we had advice, which is 1.0. We had financial planning as we understand it today at 2.0. I think where we're moving and where we ought to be moving as a profession is to really actually accentuate the impact that we can have on our clients, of their lives, their families' lives, and society as a whole, and really start to change the narrative around money and indeed what we all do working within financial services.
Yeah, great. And I think that's what the IFW has sort of been launched to, or has been established to do. So could you maybe talk to me a bit about how that came about in the first place? When was it launched and why was it launched?
It was a careless tweet one Thursday afternoon. I did a tweet saying I was a bit bored, frankly, at the time. And I just said, if I did a financial wellbeing conference, would anybody come? And about 35 people said yes. Well, I may as well then, you know. And we had, in the end, I don't know, 80 or so people come out of Bristol for a brilliant day, actually. At the end of that, I said, look, what next? You know, I'm writing stuff about this, but why don't we all do something together? So I put out a press release and said if I set up an Institute for Financial Wellbeing, who would join? And 450 people responded. So again, wow. Oh my God, I've got to do this thing now. So I phoned up a mate of mine, a solicitor, and said, could you set up a company called the Institute of Financial Wellbeing, please? And he said, no, you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to use the word institute without the express permission of the Secretary of State. So having massively now embarrassed myself publicly, I thought, how do I get out of this one? So I thought, if I call it the IFW and then call it the initiative, then one day when we get institute status, I can just change it and nobody will notice, which of course I completely
ruined. I was going to ask if that was the case. Did you sort of call it the IFW in mind?
Yeah. And so I keep telling the story. So therefore I keep drawing attention to the fact that I made that silly boo-boo. A really, really important thing I want to get across here, Lois, is that the IFW was set up to bring people together. We're becoming more and more fractured as a profession. Lots of people are doing their own training courses. We've got different bodies. And I know the irony is I've done another body to, you know, to possibly fracture it even more. But the whole point of the IFW is to be a meeting place for like-minded people who want to talk about these new areas of behavior, finance, and stuff that Ruth talked about, coaching, financial coaching, which are two different things, which maybe we can come back to. And we want everybody to bring their stuff together. So what we don't want to happen with financial wellbeing as it develops is we don't want people taking the ideas and then creating their own course for it almost as competition. If you do want to create your own course, great, bring it to us. We'll publicize it. You know, that's the whole point. It's about bringing people together. So don't people go off and use their own terms for it, like financial wellness. Just use financial wellbeing. It's becoming well known. Create your own definitions of it. You don't need to. The research has already given us the definitions. So that really is what we stand for, is a place to bring people together. If somebody's got a great idea or they've got a different angle, it's not competition. Bring it in. Let's share it and let's all talk about it. That's the whole point.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's quite a lot of instances in the financial services sector where people do have sort of slightly different terms for the same thing, and it does create quite an issue. So yeah, definitely agree. So I did just want to talk about sort of financial wellness there, sorry. financial well-being a bit more in sort of broader terms. And one of my questions was, obviously we've sort of coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic now. What sort of impact do you think that's had on people's financial stability, especially going into the cost of living crisis now?
So I think before I answer that question, Lois, it's maybe helpful just to take a tiny step back and think about the broader concept of well-being. And there's been a lot of research, and Gallup did a particularly formative piece of research on what actually creates well-being for individuals. And it turns out that there are, broadly speaking, five pillars. Those are physical well-being. There is having a community and being part of a community and feeling that you are belong to something. This kind of career slash purpose well-being. There is social well-being, which is the strength of your relationships with your family and your friends. And then there is financial well-being, which is your ability to connect healthily with your money. And of course, financial well-being spreads across all of those other four factors that I've mentioned to a greater or lesser extent. It's kind of, in many respects, I think money is the glue that holds us together as a society, for better or for worse. So then if we drop down to what does financial well-being mean, and Chris will correct me if I get this wrongly, but again, Chris kind of identified five different aspects which come together to provide us with financial well-being. And the first one being a clear path to identifiable goals. And we'll come back and maybe talk about what that means in a moment. There is having control of your day-to-day finances, which could be things like such as budgeting, and is particularly pertinent with the climate that we're currently living in around the cost of living increases. There is protecting those that you love, so making sure that you have all the necessary insurances in place. There is having choices, so having the ability to manage your money such that you're able to make decisions and choices in life. And then the final one is basically making sure you leave your loved ones in a good place when you depart this earth. And so if we think about the financial advice or financial planning process at the present moment in time, a good financial planner will probably be looking at those various factors to a greater, lesser extent anyway. However, when I reflect back on my career as a financial planner, I'm kind of conscious that I could have dug deeper into a number of these different issues if I'd have understood more about behavioral finance and the way people behave around money, different personality types. But also, I think if I'd ever had a deeper skill set in really understanding and questioning people to enable them to actually really find what's important to them rather than just what Instagram tells them is a good life, or what they've been brought up to believe that you work till you're 60 and then you retire, don't you? So for me, I think financial well-being can change people's lives, or it can certainly change their relationship with money and the stuff that people otherwise might accumulate. Have I missed anything, Chris?
No, I think that was brilliant, Ruth. Absolutely brilliant. I want to just share one little bit of theory as a way of answering that, Lois, or addressing this. And by the way, I am so aware that a bunch of financial advisors who have, sold their business and been comfortably off don't want to start lecturing people about you shouldn't be using your money to be happy and cost of living it can be so patronizing. So we've got to be very careful not to start doing that. But there is one particular angle I want to just spend a few minutes just describing for you, because I think it does help, which is a psychological theory called set point theory. Okay, now this theory says that, and it's a very well researched theory, says that we get our happiness from three areas. Okay, and what happens is we oscillate around that set level that we end up with. So if you have a set level of happiness, it means that sometimes you're slightly more happy, but you come back down to it. sometimes something rubbish happens, and then you come back up to it, but you always come back to that set level. Now, two things. Firstly, I think this is fascinating that research suggests 50% of that set level is inherited. So when you get to adulthood, you already have that in your DNA, how happy you're going to be. Isn't that amazing? Secondly, another 10% of it comes from your circumstances. So that means your job, your wealth, etc. That leaves 40%, which comes from your attitude. Now, this is all from a book by, and forgive me if I pronounce her name wrong, Sonia Lyubomirsky. I forgot what it's called. I'll find that in a minute and tell you what it's called. I was just reading it. And I don't know where. Oh, there it is. I'll put it here. It is called The How of Happiness. And she's a researcher into all these things. And so when we look at financial planning and we talk to clients about their money, we're looking at the 10%. We're trying to help them achieve better circumstances. Let's suppose you help somebody improve their circumstances by 20%. That's only 10% of overall well-being. So you're only actually affecting 2% of overall well-being. Whereas if we talk to people about their attitudes and their mental approach to money, their relationship to money, that's 40%. So we've got a lot more that we can affect. So that's the first thing that I would say. I mean, that's almost a reason to back up Ruth's version 3 framing of financial well-being and why all advisors should be getting into this stuff. But it also says that when money is difficult, focus on the attitude to money rather than, you know, this is not just the spending, although that is important too, and the budgeting. The second thing that comes out of set point theory is that we're oscillating around. So can we affect it? So what happens is, and I'll illustrate this with a quick story. I love my cricket. I went to see Gloucestershire in the summer, and when I got there, it started to rain. So a bit hacked off, sat around for a while. It continued to rain. Eventually, I gave up, and I came home. And on the way home, I also loved my music, so I stopped in a record shop, and I bought a couple of records. And as I was driving back, I suddenly realized I've just done the very thing that I talk to people about. I bought something to give me a short-term hit of well-being to get me back up to my set point. There's even a name for this, retail therapy. This yep. is, and I refer to this, the phrase I use is financial well-being junkies. We're all financial well-being junkies, buying short-term hits of well-being to keep us up to that set point. So if times are difficult, maybe we just look at where we're spending, and are we spending on long-term well-being, experiences, etc., or are we falling for that trick of buying short-term hits?
Yeah, definitely. I used to certainly be in the camp of retail therapy, buying short-term hits, but I think I'm sort of moving towards experiences now. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there's the saying, money doesn't make you happy. But then from what you've just said, mindset towards money can certainly make you happy. So, sorry, Ruth, do you want to say something?
No, I was just listening to Chris, and Chris probably bought two kind of like wildly unusual pieces of vinyl, I'm guessing, knowing Chris. But I kind of like, you know, I was just going to say, you know, sometimes maybe it is okay just to get those short hits, as long as, you know, they're in, you know, defined ways, and they just do give you a little bit of a fillip in a bad day. But I think it's like keeping your eye on the long, on the bigger prize, isn't it, really? And, you know, and the point you also make, Chris, about, yeah, two bloody financial planners who've sold their business like in the, something in their 50s, banging on about, you know, it's not about wealth, it's about happiness. You're absolutely right to say we're not here to tell people what to do, but I think there's sometimes some life experience that makes you just go, yeah, do you know what was that about? Yeah. And you know, what does really make you happy? And it absolutely is, you know, experiences and being with friends and families and doing stuff that's important, I think. And it's, you know, I think sometimes it's just kind of helping people remember that.
And what you say about it's okay to spend sometimes, what we've got to be careful of is looking for bad outcomes. And if somebody, you know, let's be blunt, I could afford to spend £40 yeah. on a couple of albums. You know, it was Cherry Ghost, by the way, to answer your question about who it was.
Blank stare.
I remember it well.
Yeah, that went over my head too, sorry.
but I could afford that. It wasn't causing me hardship. And it wasn't stopping me from getting to my ultimate, you know, goals. And we can talk about that as well. So it's aware these things are causing poor outcomes is where we've got to be very careful. But of course, those poor outcomes can be cumulative. So if I keep doing that, it feels okay, you know, to use the classic boomer criticism of millennials about buying avocado toast or whatever it is. You know, if it's there's nothing wrong in that, if that's what you like. But if you're doing it every day, it might stop you getting to your long-term financial objectives. So that's the kind of framing of it, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's like I used to buy a coffee every morning, and each time it was only £3, and I was like, oh, that's only £3. But I did it every day, and one day I added up how much it cost me over a month, and it was a ridiculous amount, and so I stopped.
Yeah, that's yeah, I don't. I'm never ever going to add up how much my records cost. my mother-in-law once said to me, we've been into town shopping, and I came back and I had about 1500 albums and about 3000 CDs, and I came back with a record. I'm quite old, it's accumulated over a long time. I came back with a record, and she looked at my record collection, she looked at me, she said, when you buy a record, what do you do with all the old ones?
Brilliant. Yes.
You make a good point, though, Lois, you know, with your coffee example. And, you know, again, back to thinking about the, you know, the cost of living crisis at the present moment in time. You know, I think all of us can learn by noticing some of those things. So, you know, an example for me recently, I suddenly saw coming out of my bank account, I think it was like 79 quid to Amazon. I'm like, well, I haven't bought anything. What's that about? And it's that subscription to Amazon Prime that I took out a couple of years ago, and I kind of suddenly thought, do I really need that? You know, and I think there's a really good exercise for all of us, no matter where we are on our journey, to just like really stop and reflect on some of these things that we've just taken on because it felt like a good idea at the time, but we don't use it. So I think without a doubt, I think there's going to be a number of people who are going to need a lot of help and support and coaching and reframing as we enter into the autumn and winter in, you know, what without doubt is tricky times at the moment. So, like, you know, I think to think about some of the principles that exist within financial wellbeing, I think it's going to be super helpful when we're talking to a number of our clients, even if they don't need to worry. People like to worry, don't they? The media tells them to worry. It's everywhere. So if we can help with people and their way they think about things, I think that's a massive benefit.
Yeah, definitely. So how big a role do you think education should play? I've had quite a lot of conversations with people, and there's sort of differing views, because one argument is that there's already a multitude of information out there on Google that people can just look at. Also, lots of people do know what they shouldn't be doing. But the other sort of side of it, I suppose, is lots of people maybe don't realise and do need a bit of education. So what's your sort of view on that? Chris, I can see you sort of dancing about. Did you want to say
something? Oh, so much to say on this. So there's a couple of things. Firstly, we are not designed to be good with money. We're not designed to think long term about financial planning. If you think back, it's only since the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher brought in private pensions, Maxwell fell off his boat, and all the final salary schemes in the private sector were shut down, that we were all, and longevity massively increasing over the last 50 years, 60 years. Suddenly we have long periods of not working that we have to fund ourselves. That's only come about in the last 40 years in the entire history of mankind. We're not built to make good financial planning decisions. So by being given that personal responsibility, we should be also given some knowledge and education on how to do it, but we don't. So I think the lack of financial education in the UK is nothing short of scandalous, and it's absolutely outrageous, a massive problem. However, the financial education that does tend to exist either focuses only on how to budget and how to manage your debt, which is important. It's one of the five pillars of financial well-being. Or it just focuses on products. What is a pension? How does an ISA work? And there is nothing that I've seen around financial well-being, about your relationship to money, the sort of stuff that we've just been talking about. So that's why we are needed. That's why the IFW exists. Because this stuff is not being talked about and it's not being educated. If you look at a lot of the financial, this is big stuff in the workplace, right? There's loads, financial well-being is all over the place in the workplace. MAPS do loads of stuff. Financial well-being is central to the Money and Pension Service. 4 out of 5 of the MAPS pillars are all about something to do with debt and budgeting. The fifth one is long-term. that's in our space, but they don't do anything with that at the moment. That's an aspirational area for them. Now, I understand why they're dealing with the general public, and those priorities are absolutely fine. But we should also be getting into some education. If somebody's getting into debt, why not talk about them about the financial well-being junkie idea and review their spending, as Ruth's been talking about, because then they might not get into debt in the first place. So, yeah, I absolutely agree. Financial education is scandalously short. But if we're going to solve that problem, it needs to be on a financial well-being slant, not just on debt and budgeting and products.
And how much of that do you think should take place in schools? Because that's another thing that I've seen a lot about. It's sort of, we don't really have financial education. I certainly didn't at school.
Yeah, it's a common refrain, isn't it, Lois? And I think I've got two thoughts on that. My first reaction is, yes, it should happen much more in school and in a way that children can understand and relate to. However, if you think about all of us and the way we learn, we tend to learn best when something is pertinent and relevant to where we are in our lives. And so I think it's kind of planting the seeds, but, you know, throughout childhood. My 10-year-old niece came to stay with me last week, and, you know, like a good auntie financial planner that I am, this was on a IFW round table. There was a guy whose name, Will Rayner, I think he's called, talking about Grandpa's Financial Fables or some such book. And I gave it to my niece, thinking that she might just toss it to one side. And she gobbled it up. And then when I was taking her home, she was telling me with great passion about how you could have if you have a strawberry farm, that you could do this, that and the other with the seeds, and, you know, use it to get more money and employ people. I thought that was fascinating, that a 10-year-old within 2 hours reading a book in a way that was accessible to her enabled her to hopefully pick up a couple of principles. My sister, her mom, did tell me that later that evening she was actually telling her mom about how to manage her money. So there is something in it, but I think it's getting the level right and appropriate for the stage of learning that kids have. But without doubt, it also then needs to be available, you know, as we get into adulthood, as we are, you know, coping with student debt, as we're thinking about buying our first home, as we're thinking about pensions, as we think to the future, because none of us can imagine what we're going to be like when we're old. In fact, it's the last thing we want to think about. So we need to bring it into people's consciousness in a way that they will actually see themselves and take notice in.
We know, research tells us, that if you are a person that sees money as an objective in life, you will be less happy than you will otherwise be. Okay. So Tim Kasser on our Financial Wellbeing podcast, a professor in America. And by the way, just backing up something Ruth was saying about getting the right information at the right time, otherwise it won't be listened to. Fabulous book called Advice That Sticks by Moira Summers is all about that, specifically for financial advice, how to give people financial advice that people will follow. She's great too. I've got my children are both in kind of university leaving home age, and a number of their friends have gone on to do financial type degrees, and whenever I speak to them, we also had some contact with the local university, IFW contact as well, and whenever I speak to these people, what do you want to do with your degree in financial advice? Oh, I want to be an investment analyst. Oh, Christ, really? Is that it? Is that what they're teaching you? You know, so even in the financial advice type degree, there's none of this stuff in there. It's all the focus is of how to help people to get wealthier. And we should be helping them to get healthier and happier. And the wealthier should just be a byproduct, if at all, you know. So even the financial education that is in there is deeply flawed, in my view, because the focus is all wrong. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't understand a pension, although I would argue that when somebody comes to see a financial advisor, the one thing they don't want to know is anything about their money. That's why you go to see a financial advisor. Using the cliched old example, if I go to the garage, I don't want to know what they're doing to my car. I just want to know what time to pick it up. You know, and will it help me get to see Gloucestershire play cricket next week or whatever? You know, that's what matters, the purpose of this stuff. So the financial education I have seen tends to be very much about products and about getting more money, investment management, all that stuff. Most boring part of money as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so bringing it back to advisors then, what, and also you mentioned financial coaches earlier. What sort of role do you think both financial advisors and financial coaches have in making sure their clients are financially well? What can they sort of do?
Well, I'll start off, if I may, because I just want to make one that there's a lot of words as people try and market themselves to be a bit different, as we touched on earlier on. People are coming up with an awful lot of phrases to describe the same thing, basically. You think, what phrases do you think of when you think of a financial advisor, financial planner, lifestyle financial planning, real financial planning, wealth manager, shaping financial? So did I see something the other day? I listed them once, and there was about 25 different things, and they're all basically saying similar things. And the two that are particularly confusing just at the moment is coaching and financial coaching. So I'm a business coach. I qualified in 2013, a diploma qualified business coach. And I remember going to the IFP conference, as it was then, and doing a talk on coaching skills. So when I talk about coaching, all I'm talking about is good listening and questioning skills. You have no toolkit. There's nothing that there's no games that there's no design. It's just really listening and helping somebody else to think. That's what I think all advisors should be trained in. Another phrase for it could be interpersonal skills, but I'm not that keen on, but if it explains it, that's cool. Financial coaching, as promoted by Simone Ganesson and now Catherine Morgan's doing great things, that is a toolkit of things to help people with get a better relationship to money. It includes listening in questions. It's got to be part of it, but they've got various different things that they can bring in to help you frame your thinking. So the two things are quite different, and coaching skills for advisors is relatively simple to learn. Financial coaching is a big area of its own right, non-regulated and really cool stuff going on. But I just wanted to clarify what those two terms mean in their different contexts.
Thank you.
Great. I think that was really helpful as well, Chris. And I think that is also, I would totally agree with that. When I think about it from a financial planner's perspective, what I would encourage financial planners, because we all think we're good at having conversations and having relationships with our clients and that we listen. But I think it's just taking that to the next level. And then there are some great trainers out there that I think can really help us develop those coaching questions. And for me, when I reflect back when I was talking to clients, I can remember taking very often answers client gave me at face value. I think I could have dug a little bit deeper and maybe got to some real gold. And I also really think as well, when I think about it, what stopped me asking those questions? And I think there's a very Britishness about us that think, oh, that's a bit rude. Oh, I don't know whether I should say that. Is that a bit cheeky? Will I upset someone? And I think it's almost getting over ourselves sometimes and building our own confidence, which I think will enhance relationships with our clients, which will therefore enhance the business relationships that we have. And heck, these are skills that we can use in all of the relationships that we come across in our lives. So I think there is really something in there where we can go deeper. And that would be my encouragement to financial planners.
If I could give your listeners to this podcast one tip, Lois, a financial wellbeing coaching type tip. There's one tool that advisors have that I think is the most underutilized tool, and I'm being particularly bad at demonstrating it myself today, which is silence. If you think that, and this is just pick up on Ruth's point about advisors tend to not go deep enough. This is the most common thing that we find when we at the RFW, we have an audit of the firm. So somebody who wants to say, use the logo on their website can go through a financial wellbeing audit where we'll ask them various questions, ask for evidence, and we will give them guidance on how they can deliver financial wellbeing throughout their practice. And one of the most common things we see is people not going deep enough. So let's just take an example that somebody, you know, I want a pension review. What's the purpose of this pension review? I want to retire at 60. Is that where you stop? Okay, you retire at 60. How did you come up with the age of 60? What about 63? What about 58? Conversation happens. Client tells you, well, that's because that's when my dad retired. I don't know. Next thing you do is not speak. For as long as it takes, the client must be the next one to speak, because what they've done is they've used what's called System One thinking. They have just given you a gut answer, the answer that they've given everybody else. In order to get them to use a more thoughtful answer, just don't say anything. They will fill in that silence, and they will probably give you something really quite meaningful about what actually does retirement really, really look like. You could just say to them, after then, if you still haven't got anywhere, just say, so 60 and a day, you wake up. What's going to give your life meaning and purpose? Again, shut up. Don't say another thing. Silence is so, so important, and so vastly underused in my role-playing experience.
That's interesting you say that. It's exactly what they tell journalists when they're interviewing people as well. Stay silent and they'll probably tell you something else because they'll be so uncomfortable they want to fill the silence.
Yeah, classic.
But in fairness to you, Chris, if you'd have been silent on a podcast, that would be tricky, wouldn't it? So we'll let you off this
time. Yeah, that would have been a bit awkward, yeah. Great. Was there anything else either of you wanted to, any sort of final thoughts that you wanted to give before we wrap up?
So many. So many. I just want people to, the point of the IFW is to make the world a happier place, right? And we want to do that by helping people to realize that money as an objective will make you less happy. And I get a few advisors who say, well, yeah, that's all very well and good, but this doesn't apply to my clients because they're already quite wealthy. Well, I think if financial planning and cash flow was the big thing of the last 10 years, and if coaching skills is the big thing and well-being is the big thing of now, I think the biggest thing over in 10 years' time will be philanthropy. Because philanthropy is a huge potential source of well-being. So let me ask you a question, Lois. I think Ruth knows this one. So let me ask you, Lois. Have a guess, right? If ultra-high net worth is 10 million or more in assets, okay. Yeah. How much do you think ultra high net worth people give to charity each year on average in pounds?
In pounds.
Get the listeners thinking about this, a number for this as well.
50,000?
50,000 on average. The average amount given is £400.
400?
Yeah. Ah. That's an average. So when you think J.K. Rowling gives her hundreds of millions and Marcus Rashford, that's an average. So the majority of people with 10 million or more in assets give nothing to charity. And there are a number of reasons why, but one of them is because nobody asks them to. Especially in the UK, this is an awkward conversation. So philanthropy advisors that we've had on in the IFW have told us, we actually have a philanthropy course for advisors that we run as well, or that we bring in. People want you to bring it up. They actually want you to. So I think philanthropy planning is going to be the big thing because it's a huge source of well-being. And I just bring that up as it's an example of the sort of stuff that the IFW is all about, that we want to bring people in to share these things and bring their own courses in and let's all get together and make the world a happier place by doing this sort of stuff.
That sounds really great. Ruth, do you have any final thoughts you wanted to give?
I think my final thoughts to anybody listening who hasn't experienced the Institute for Financial Wellbeing is come and take a look at her. You know, come and have a look. Join us. I think we're on a really exciting journey here. And don't get me wrong, I know financial planners, financial advisors, they have a lot on their plate. They've got a lot of technical stuff to be keeping up to speed with. They've got a lot of compliance and regulatory stuff. I would argue this is the stuff that really matters. But most importantly, I think a huge amount of people find this stuff really interesting once they start to really think about it. So come and join us. Come and listen. We do some amazing events. There's at least three events each month, the roundtable, the forum, and the cafe, which is over a lunchtime. There's stacks of resources on our website. Come and have a look. Come and listen. Come and tell us what you think. We're here for you. We want to make this better for everybody. And we'd love to see you. So, yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity, Lois. It's really good to be able to, extend the message and, hopefully pique people's interest.
Yeah, definitely. No, well, I personally find it all really fascinating. So, yeah, thank you both so much for joining me. It's been really great to chat to you today. I've had a great time. And to our listeners, please do keep up to date with all our new releases via Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else that you get your podcasts from. You can also find all our new content published on Money Marketing on our website, as well as Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. And see you again for our next podcast.